Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, broadcast and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. You're about to hear is true, even if it sounds implausible, even for fiction. It's about a little girl named Danielle, the girl in the window, described in Lane DeGregory's story in the St. Petersburg Times that won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. I remember the day that Lane's story first appeared in the paper. My wife, who's an editor in the Times News Features Department, came home that night talking about the crazy traffic at the newspaper's website, all drawn to the incredible tale of the feral child. Within days, there were 1,200 comments posted to the paper's website about just this story. Now, here's an audio clip from the online presentation of that story that winds up including audio, video, and photography that complements Lane's sparkling prose.
You walk in the front door, the walls are stained yellow, along with the roof and curtains from cigarette smoke and other things. There's dried food and dog feces splattered on the wall. There's a strong stench of urine, both animal and human, all through the house. There are literally thousands and thousands of German cockroaches. Everywhere you look, every place you step, you can hear them crunching under your feet. Everything you look at is moving. That is by far the worst neglect situation I've ever seen. And I've seen a bunch.
Danielle Crockett was 6 years old, starving, wearing a diaper, and unable to talk when police took her from her home in July 2005. She spent almost 2 years in the hospital and foster care. Finally, in 2007, the child who had been left alone for most of her life found a family. Could their love make up for a lifetime of neglect? This is Lane DeGregory with the St. Petersburg Times.
I can tell you that Lane DeGregory is one of the most admired reporters at the St. Pete Times, a newspaper that has won its share of Pulitzers over the last quarter century, but she's also one of the best-liked journalists at the paper as well. Lane, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you for having me, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Glad we're finally getting some rain here in Florida.
Yeah, yeah, there's been a bit of that today, hasn't there? So, life settling down a little bit, or is it still going in cockeyed directions?
It's still a little bit crazy, to tell you the truth. I've heard some people in my life that I lost for the last 30 years, and that's just been really incredible to be able to reconnect with so many people from different pieces of my past.
Most of them come around looking for money, and you have to tell them that this is not the Nobel Prize?
Only a couple of them, actually. I was able to talk to my old high school journalism teacher, which was just probably the coolest part of all. I completely lost him, and he was the reason that, you know, that I'm here today, so that was pretty cool.
That would be cool. Well, let's talk a little about the story. I mean, at what point in the reporting of the story, you know, before it published, obviously, did you know it was going to be something special?
Well, I guess I knew when I first heard the tip that it was something special. The woman who works at the Children's Board of Hillsborough County, who's been a wonderful source for me for probably 5 or 6 years now, she called and basically said, you know, I have this story about a little girl who is in our heart gallery. We put her up to be adopted. We never thought there would be any prayer for her of actually finding a family. We were hoping that maybe the best thing we could find for her would be a nice nursing home. This is a little girl, she said, who's been kept in a closet for all of her life until they found her when she was 6 years old. Now, I'd never heard a story like that, either, you know, on either end, either a children's board worker saying this is an unadoptable child, you know, because they're always about, like, oh, we can find any kid a family. So that startled me. But then when she got to the punchline about where the little girl had come from, I knew from that moment that it was a special story. I didn't know how big it was going to be or what we were going to follow for the paper. until probably about 3 months into it, my editor just kept saying, you know, my editor Mike Wilson was wonderful about this. He said, just let's follow it and see where it goes. You know, so first we went forward. First we went, okay, here's this family who's going to take her in, and we spend as much time as we could with them and with her. And then we went backward trying to find out what had happened to her. What did this profound neglect mean in terms of what her future capabilities of development and language acquisition might be? So we kind of, you know, I was taking it forward in terms of, oh, look at this incredible family. And my editor said, let's make it a more broader perspective than that and see how this happened to her and what that means.
How much time did you put into this from the time you got the tip to the time it published?
It was about 6 months altogether. And I did 24 other stories during that time. So it wasn't anything I was, you know, cut loose to do exclusively. But I worked on that all along through 6 months. The family lived in Fort Myers, which was about a three-hour drive from here. So, you know, if they'd been here in the area, we would have gone to see them every week. But as it was, I'm sorry, we'd gone to see them every day probably, or at least check in every day. But as it was, we were only able to go down there about once a month. So over that six-month period, I think we made 5 or 6 trips to see them. And then it would be immersion. You know, then it would be like for 3 days at a time or for a whole weekend or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And you hold to something like this and you're thinking, yeah, this is special. And then are you worried, you know, can I pull it off? Can I give it the I don't know, the zest?
Oh, yeah, am I worthy?
Something special? Yeah, right.
Am I worthy?
Mean, you know.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And this story, you know, other people, a TV station down in Fort Myers had approached this family about doing the story, and they said, no, we don't want any media attention. And the lady from the Children's Board actually worked with the social worker who'd worked with Danielle to talk the family into letting us do the story. So there was also that pressure, like, you know, not only is it an incredible story, am I worthy of telling it, but also am I going to do the family justice when I know they're not out there seeking help or publicity or, you know, they weren't trying to get me to tell their story. I was having to talk them into sharing it. And they were very worried about how she would be portrayed. You know, so Melissa Little and I, she's a photographer who did the beautiful images that went with it. And we talked about that a lot. Like, you know, how are we going to show this little girl that shows the sort of just the gravity of the situation she came from without making her seem like less than human, you know? And so that was a delicate thing we tried to balance.
It is amazing. I haven't done something quite like this, but I've had stories where, you know, there's been a murder or there's been this, and you have time and you know there's something special going on, but, you know, sometimes you wonder if you're the right match for the story. Does it play to your strengths? And obviously it did.
Well, and the first part of the story really was my strength, I think, which is working with the family and watching things evolve and narrating things as they happen. The second part was something I hadn't done in a few years, and that was really dig through a lot of documents and do court and, you know, medical record research type things. So I did get some help from Karen Baird, a wonderful news researcher, and helped me a lot in the story, too. So it was playing to other people's strengths as well, I think.
Karen Baird, I know, has had a lot of experience at this kind of thing. I mean, a lot of newspapers are not giving the reporters and their teams the opportunity to do this kind of thing anymore. Is that different at the time still today?
Is what? I'm sorry.
Is it different at the times in terms of Mike Wilson? You know, let's develop this, let's flesh it out. You're working. You know, you've got Karen Baird helping you with research. You've got Melissa Little helping you, you know, working on the art. And it seems like a lot of that's kind of disappearing on us.
Well, I think one of the reasons I wanted to come to the Times, I've been here almost 9 years, was because I know they really do value storytelling. I think what might have shifted is being cut loose to do a project like this, where that's the only thing you work on for months at a time, versus can you balance doing this and also do dailies as you go along, or do weekenders for me, you know. Mike was great about not giving me a final deadline about when this project had to be done, but he also, you know, and I knew that I needed to keep writing other stories as well. I couldn't just, like, say, take me off the books for everything else, you know. I think the Times definitely still has the resources, and maybe even more than ever before. Besides the folks we've already mentioned, I had help from Desiree Perry did beautiful web design. I had Jack Rowland helped with all of the video and audio production. Ted McLaren did the podcast and the audio interviews for the web page. So, you know, we had this whole other IT level to this. I've been doing this 20 years, Bob, 21 years. I've never done a multimedia before. And so having all those other brains and minds, you know, included in the presentation of this and having to go, okay, maybe I can't write it all with my words. You know, maybe there are pieces of this that are better off shown or heard. That was a big shift, you know, but it also really made me appreciate the other folks at the Times and the layering of journalism that we're now trying to explore, you know, in different forms of storytelling.
Do you think the story turned out differently because you had several months to stretch it out? You literally had to stretch it out because you couldn't focus on it. But, I mean, if you'd done the story in a day or two, would it have been a very different story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if I'd done it in a day or two, it would have just been the miracle of this little girl being adopted, you know. It would have had to be a much tighter focus. And by the other thing that was cool, because they didn't live right here, we didn't see them every day or even every week, was when we would go back a month later, we could tell things had changed. We could actually see progress in Danny. You know, we would be there 1 week and she couldn't put food in her mouth with a fork. And the next week, oh my gosh, the next month she'd be feeding herself ham. You know, she was completely in diapers at first. And then by the time we caught up with her, you know, 2 months down the road, she was potty trained. And it was really cool. You could watch her progress from afar, which we never would have been able to document for ourselves if we hadn't had that span of time, you know. I think it also gave us a chance to step back and maybe look at it from a broader lens. I got a lot of chance on my own to research other feral children and other cases where they tried to teach child language, you know, when they were deprived of it for years and years. And so putting it more in the context of, because when we were down there, you know, when we were immersed in it, it was like 3 hours in the car. Oh, my gosh, can you believe that, you know, coming back? And we had to sort of space it out a little bit.
It's interesting, you know, I know you're a parent, you've had kids. You are too close day to day to see the growth and development, and then someone who hasn't seen your kid in a month or 6 months says, "Wow, Johnny's grown so much." And I guess you got to see that and experience that with the story.
Exactly, and on, you know, ways we wouldn't have thought to ask about either. You know, like starting.
What do you think? Go ahead.
I was going to say, being able to let herself go to sleep at night. You know, I wouldn't have thought to ask that. But self-comforting, you know, we watched that kind of evolve too, which was cool.
Why do some stories, like this one obviously, they grab at our heartstrings and they refuse to let go? I mean, in a year, newspapers publish hundreds of sad stories.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot. Like, what was it about this story versus all the hundreds of stories I've done, you know, over the years? And I think the basic question that it made us all look at was what makes us human. And so I think anybody could relate to it in a way that maybe not everybody can relate to their house being foreclosed on or a fire sweeping through their city or something like that if it's never happened to you. But all of us have been a child or cared for a child, and there were two parts. I think the first part was the, oh my gosh, how could that happen factor, that you don't even really want to believe that something that horrific would go on in 21st century America, you know, right under our nose. So as a neighbor or as a parent, you feel that sort of disbelief and outrage. But then, like you said, there's all these sad, horrible stories of abuse and neglect. But what this one had was hope. And the Lilos adopting her, giving her a family, gave it that other component that a lot of my stories that say, you know, here's this poor kid waiting to be adopted, don't have. There's somebody's hoping for that, but it hasn't happened, and you don't know if there's going to be a happy ending. I mean, we didn't know in this story, and we still don't know, is Danny ever going to be able to talk? Is she ever going to be able to live on her own? You know, there's lots of questions that aren't answered, but we do know that she's laughing. She's learning to give somebody a hug. She can feed herself and not poo on herself. And it's huge. I mean, you watch a completely ignored off the radar being, evolve into a loved member of a family and a community and a church. And it, I think that part of it made a big difference for people too. I think, well, I know it inspired people to go, my gosh, you know, if this family can take in that little girl, why can't I do something more? Even if it's just call, the child abuse hotline had a huge increase in calls. And people were like, you know, I was wondering, this kid in my neighborhood, but I never called before. And so I think it touched people, I guess is my short answer. I think it touched people, you know, both with outrage and with hope.
Now, you came into the story when she was being adopted, at the point she was being adopted, and did not actually see the rental house that she was in at the time. But you put that together through, as you mentioned, the documents, police reports. Can you give people who have not read the story yet a sense of what kind of conditions this little girl was living in? She was about 6 or 7, I think.
Yeah, and actually, Bob, you know what? We did get to get in that rental house. It was amazing. The mother had moved out, and they had the house condemned shortly after the Child Protective Services took Danielle, but nobody else had moved into it. And Melissa and I knew we wanted to see the house, at least to be able to describe it and photograph where this abuse had taken place, and to know, you know, like, how close are the neighbors? Could somebody else have seen to know something? You know, is it out in the woods? Is it on the street? So we had the address from the police reports, and we drove up there one day. And it was a little rural road, but there were about 5 or 6 houses and a little church on it. And as we pulled up and parked in this parking lot of the church and got out of the car, these two little boys who are about my kids' age, they're like 10 and 12, they come running up like, hey, who are you? You know, what are you doing? And we told them. And they said, oh, that's the house where she lived in right there. And they lived next door. So here are these two little boys about the same age as Danny who lived, I mean, literally 2 driveways apart all this time. And they said, my dad owns that house now. Do you want to see inside? And we were like, you got to be kidding. You know, how does that ever happen? And they opened the window. They didn't have a key. They opened the window. Their mom came out. We told their mom who we were. She's like, sure, have at it. Nothing much has changed in there. It's still disgusting. So this was maybe 3 years later, you know, but we climbed through this window, and nobody really claimed much of anything. So we got to, Melissa got to photograph it. I got to write about it. We could see the bare electric wires that should have held the light bulb hanging down. It was really like a garage. It was like a single car garage that was attached to the house, and they'd nailed 3 doors sideways over where the garage door would have been to make a wall. So if you can imagine that type of space, but the garage doors didn't come all the way to the bottom of the ground. So there were reports in the abuse investigation about snakes coming in under there and all kind of bugs and lizards and stuff that could just crawl into this room with the cement floor where Danny was kept. The window was broken, you know, shattered and totally grimy. The whole house was like from cigarette smoke. It was yellow cobwebs. As thick as saran wrap that you could just, they were hanging on layer upon layer, roaches, dead roaches everywhere. That was not many years later, and it was still disgusting.
Getting to get in there
was amazing.
Well, I was going to say, giving you credit for going through the window in this house, that I assume that you have already read the police report, so you know how disgusting it's going to be in there. Not a lot of women, tough police reporters would have done that. Like, yeah, I think I'll wait.
I wanted to, like, be able to smell it and see it. And Melissa really wanted a view out of the window, like where Danny was kept. What was she seeing? You know, what was her window on the world? And so we were ecstatic when those little boys let us in. Their mom was like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it makes all the difference. See, that answered the question that I had, was looking at the multimedia display. There's a lot of photos, you know, the sink and the tub and, I thought, were these police photos, or did Melissa shoot these? Obviously, Melissa shot these.
No, those are all police photos, actually.
Those are the police photos.
Yeah, they were off some evidence.
Okay.
Because we couldn't get out into the kitchen and the living room area. It was had been boarded up. This back room had been boarded up. So we were only able to get in the room where she'd been kept. But as far as we interviewed like three or four of the neighbors, well, and including this other family, five of the neighbors, and they all, you know, had told us how they'd never seen a little girl in the front of the house or outside the house in all those years. So the evidence photos, and actually the other problem was the evidence photos were taken like 5 days afterwards when they went back and launched a criminal investigation. So there weren't any pictures from right that day that it happened. But being inside the room and being able to look out where she was kept was really helpful.
Oh, yeah. Now, I have another piece of audio I want to play. This is from your interview with Detective Holsky, I think is his name. I'm going to play this. This will give people a little sense of what he and his partner found when they went there to investigate and ultimately remove Danielle. So listen to this.
My name is Detective Mark Holsky. I'm employed by the Plant City Police Department. The DCF worker had already been inside the house. She was out in the yard crying, and she was nauseated. And she was leaning against her vehicle, and she was extremely upset. You know, we stopped. We finally calmed her down. I said, you know, what's the problem here? I didn't know if she'd been assaulted or what the situation was. And she said she'd never seen a neglect situation quite like this one before, and it was extremely disturbing to her. The child slept on a mattress that was on the floor. There was actually no bed in there. It was a single mattress that had been soiled many, many, many times over. As you opened the door, the stench was very overpowering to the point where my partner had to go outside. The child was nonverbal, meaning could only make grunting sounds, was in a diaper, like a size 6 diaper, infant-sized diaper, which was extremely soiled and leaking out the legs and down out the sides of the legs and running down the legs. The child had insect bites, which from my training classes for homicide classes and stuff, I tell you their roach bites, had thousands of roach bites from the tip of her toes to the top of her head. Yeah, I can't imagine going to sleep at night knowing that you're going to be, you know, a smorgasbord as soon as you lay down to insects. Oh, I still have dreams about it. Yeah, that was bad. You know, the mother just could not give a reliable explanation. She was visibly upset when we took the child. She was crying. Understandable. I'm a parent. I understand. You know, I can't imagine someone coming and taking my child from me. You know, but in this particular case, you know, I have no doubt in my mind it saved the child's life. Her statement was, I'm doing the best I can. And my reply was, honestly, the best you can do sucks.
You got to interview Michelle Crockett, right? Before I ask you what she said in the interview, did you have some, was there a part of you that did not, I mean, there's the reporter part of you that, of course, wants to get every bit of information, but the parent and the interview thinking, not that reporters aren't human, but, I mean, is there a part of you that's going, you know, I don't even know that I want to talk to this woman. This is so heinous what happened here. But you knock on the door and she invites you in.
Oh, yeah, that was the hardest part of the story by far, and not even because of me and my own reservations or emotions, but because the family that adopted Danny, the Leroes, they didn't want to know anything about her birth mother. They didn't want to know anything about what happened to her before they got her. They both were like, you know, her life began with us, and it doesn't matter what happened before because we're here to make it better now. And so initially, Bob, I really thought I could get away with not having to talk to her. I thought that the police reports and the court cases and the medical reports were enough, you know, to try to start piecing that together. But Mike Wilson, my editor, was rightfully so very, very insistent that, no, in order to see how far this little girl has come, we need to see what she came from, and we need to know what happened to her. And this mother is this faceless demon, you know, this Boo Radley character, as he put it, who we need to see and at least give it a chance to explain it to us. So he would, you know, about every week, hey, have you found the mother yet? Hey, did you find the birth mother yet? You know, Mike's never, never overly pushy, but he would just like was completely nudging me and like letting me know I was not going to get out of this, you know? And as a parent, I guess it was kind of my curiosity as a reporter was coupled with my just outrage as a parent about, like, you know, I feel guilty when I serve my kids Cheerios for dinner because we have nothing to eat, you know, and I can't imagine a parent just so profoundly ignoring their child. And I guess part of me wanted to know, like, what was her story, you know, because it wasn't a physical abuse. It wasn't like someone snapped in rage in a moment. You could almost understand that more than over such a long, prolonged period of time. And this is a woman I know held a job at Walmart. I knew she worked outside the home. She wasn't some, like, you know, recluse unable to care for herself. So Mike pushed and pushed, and we had a hard time finding her because she'd moved from that house. The neighbors told us that she was in this trailer down the road. We looked at the trailer down the road. There were these homeless ladies with a bunch of pit bulls camped in the trailer, and they were like, no, she doesn't live here. She lives around the corner every day. But we think her landlady's name is Peg. I mean, we went through. Melissa had her iPhone. And Karen Baird was on the property records search, and we were driving all around Plant City, getting these random tips from random strangers. And finally, we find out that this realtor who owns this bunch of trailers that has another trailer over here, her name is Peg something. We're not sure. Peg, Jones, James, something. So Karen's searching all of the people who own multiple trailers with the name of Margaret, Peg, Peggy, whatever. You know, unbelievable. They finally were able to come up with the place where this woman lived, and then we were worried. You know, we kept Melissa was worried she was going to, she was worried she was going to say something out of anger because she felt a lot of animosity toward this woman without even meeting her, and I was worried what she was going to do to us because I kept thinking, God, if she could do this to her own little girl, what's she going to do to two female reporters who show up at her trailer in the middle of the afternoon, you know, unannounced and whatever. So we like backed the car in case we had to make a quick getaway. We texted our editors, like, here's where we are, you know, if something happens. And then she completely blew us away by inviting us in. You've seen my daughter. We said we want to talk to you about your daughter. Do you know where she is? How's my daughter? And she starts crying, and she goes back in and gets her house coat and her cigarettes and sits us down at her kitchen table, and we're there for like 2 hours. I don't think anybody had ever asked her story before or her side of the story. And, you know, however pathetic it was her story, you know. And another thing that really surprised us was we didn't have any pictures of Danny from when she was abused. There weren't any of those pictures in the child court files. They were all, the first one in there was from the Hart Gallery when they wanted to have her adopted. But here on the wall of the trailer of this birth mother, now she's moved 3 times since her little girl's been taken away. And the only thing hanging on the wall is this faded computer printout of a picture of Danny that she snapped in the hospital when she snuck in to see her after she was taken away. So, and she had a bag of medical records that she gave us, which we weren't able to get from the Child Protective Services. So all of a sudden we got the initial reports and everything from the hospital and the pediatricians and the neurologists that examined her, because they had to give Michelle Crockett a copy of that during her child custody hearings. So she put us all over in a huge glad garbage bag full of documents.
Well, and it was interesting to read that Danielle was the product of a basically a one-night stand in Vegas, and there's this suggestion that it's neglect and that it's abuse, but then after reading the mom's story, you get the sense that there may not have been anything she could do, and she just didn't have the understanding of systems help that might be out there to go and try to get help. She had it's hard to know, I guess, but my sense from reading is that maybe she had this kid who just had so many problems, and she was just ill-equipped to help her or know where to get help.
Yeah, I mean, it was clear that whatever Danny did or didn't have at birth, Miss Michelle was overwhelmed by her life at that point, you know, her husband had died. She had one retarded son already who, you know, was in special ed. Her house burned down. Then she has a one-night stand and finds out she's pregnant when she doesn't know she's pregnant at, like, 42 years old. Moves to Florida to live with a cousin. The cousin kicks him out, you know, and she she was definitely overwhelmed. The so many mitigating circumstances, you know, but I also just kept going, I can't imagine, no matter what was wrong with your child, that you would never take her to a doctor. And she'd never taken this child to any kind of doctor or medical clinic anywhere. And she also had the wherewithal to hold down a job at Walmart. So one of the saddest emails I got out of the 1,200 or whatever after the story came out was from this woman who said, oh my gosh, I worked with her at Walmart for 2 years. I never knew she had a child. You know, and I can't imagine that either. Like, how can you never talk about your child unless either you're so ashamed or you're so overwhelmed? But I think she came across as being a very self-centered person. It was all about her and how could they do this to her. And she, there was no culpability. She didn't think that anything that she had, she didn't think she'd done anything wrong. And if she did do anything wrong, it wasn't her fault. And she, like the detective said in that audio clip, she was doing the best she could. I mean, she really kept saying that again and again and again. And she, you know, her IQ was low as well. And no doubt in my mind, she could have benefited from some intervention and some help and some social services and some counseling. But, you know, DCF had been out there twice before and offered her free babysitting for Danny, offered her free childcare for, you know, pre-K, offered to get her help with services for the older boy who was in special ed. And she just kept saying, no, I'm fine, you know. So whether she was too proud or too clueless to take the help, I don't know, you know.
At what point did you find out about the two previous visits by DCF? Was that before you met her or after?
No, not till she gave us that bag full of documents. In fact, I had to call the police officer back and say, did you know that there had been two other visits to this woman? And he was absolutely floored because it was in, she was living in a different town than she was living in Brandon. So it wasn't under the same city. You know, it was a different address. And what had happened, this may be too like inside baseball, but when the first two times they went to investigate, DCF investigated, and the Child Protective Services was under the Department of Children and Families in the state. And their goal, their mission, is reunification, you know, keep the child with the family if at all possible. Now, they never met Danielle. They never saw Danielle. They just went and talked to the mother, and she said, oh, she's fine. You know, she's sleeping. Even the neighbors had called in and said, she's emaciated. She's always naked. She can't talk. She's 4 years old in a diaper, you know. But by the time that Detective Holstein and Plant City Police got involved, they'd switched it. And so then the police were in charge of child abuse investigations. So their goal was not keep the kid with the family. Their goal was, like, protect this kid, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was not at all aware that there had been these two previous calls, which had been, like, 2 and 3 years earlier.
Wow.
I just kept thinking about that, too. You know, how much better would she have been off, you know, if they'd gotten her the first time?
And you don't know, because no one knows exactly what kind of shape she was. Well, birth, I mean, you had paperwork, but I have one more piece of audio I want to play. This is, again, from the multimedia station at TampaBay.com, the website of the St. Pete Times, for Lane DeGregory's story, The Girl in the Window. And this is Michelle, Danielle's mom, talking about her daughter. Listen to this.
This is Lane DeGregory from the St. Petersburg Times. Danielle's birth mother, Michelle Crockett, was charged with child neglect. She was facing 20 years in prison. But she made a deal with prosecutors and gave up her parental rights, so she never had to serve time. 3 years after the authorities took her daughter away, she's still rationalizing how things went so wrong.
I begged her, please don't take my baby, and that's how it all started. Hello, my name is Michelle Crockett. I'm Danielle's mom. If it wasn't for bad luck, I have no luck at all. I had 3 deaths and a fire and a baby in 4 years. I lost my mom in 95. I lost my husband in May of 97. I lost my uncle in 99, and my house burned down in 2000, and my daughter was born in 98. That was the only good thing came out of them, 4 years. We moved to Florida to get a new start, and I had one disaster after another. They came, they took my daughter. I didn't have a chance to do anything. First she says that she was going to bring in a team to help me. Then she looked at Danielle, and she was laying on the bed. It wasn't bad, but it was old. It was a couple springs sticking up, but it wasn't the side. It wasn't sticking up like here on the mattress, but it was on like on the side, tore a little bit. She says, oh, I see her rib. She starved to death. Then they said she was dirty. Well, I know she wasn't dirty. Then they said she had no. She had some bites on her. I guess she had two bites on her belly. They just, if they couldn't attack me one way about her physically, they were attacking me about her mentally. Oh, you made her autistic because you kept her in the house. I thought she was just slow because my son, he didn't potty train until he was almost 4, but she was almost 6, and I was really getting worried because she wouldn't potty train. I miss her smile, just being with her.
Lane, parents have nightmares about the worst things that could happen to their kids. Does this top your own worst imagination?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially since it's done at the hands of her own mother, you know. And there were two brothers in the house, too, that must have at least known that she was suffering in some way, that something wasn't right about that, you know. When you read all the horrible stories in the paper about things happening to kids, it doesn't make it any better to know it was a boyfriend or a stepfather or a neighbor or somebody who did it to them, but it seems like it's so much more horrific to know that it's her own mother, especially a mother who professes to love her child.
Mm. Where are they all now? What's the last you heard of or from Michelle Crockett and then Danielle's adoptive parents?
Michelle actually went back to court last week to ask the judge to let her off probation. Her house arrest was up, I believe, in March, but she's still on probation for, I think, 8 more years, and the judge denied it. She lives with her sons in this trailer in Plant City, and not a couple miles from where she kept Danielle. She tripped over a box at Walmart and has been on disability and hasn't worked in the last couple of years. They sit at home and watch old horror movies and smoke cigarettes, and she doesn't have a car, she doesn't drive. Some lady from some mission comes and takes her to church once a week. But that's as far as I know kind of what her life is like now. Danny's family, Danielle and her brother William, who is a year older, he's 11, she's 10, their parents moved them to Tennessee at the end of school last year, so they've been in Tennessee for almost a year, in central Tennessee. And she's doing speech therapy and horseback riding therapy still. They were trying to teach her sign language, but she apparently doesn't have the dexterity or the attention span. She still doesn't even really have a pincer grasp to hold a pencil or push a button. She never really developed that fine motor skills. So the sign language wasn't working very well. They got her a little box, like a speak and spell box, where you can push a button that says, you know, potty, potty, drink, drink, you know, book, book. And so she can sometimes is able to, like, communicate her needs through that. She regressed a little bit, they said, because of the move. Her circumstances had changed. She was out of her routine and her familiar environment, and she regressed a bit on the potty training and also on her temper tantrums and her sleep. But apparently that came back again by Christmas time. After about 6 months, she was sort of back on the place where she'd been developmentally before. So they got her a couple new puppies, and she's got goats to play with on this farm they have now.
That's nice. Now, I'm sure everyone asks you this. Will this series at some point lead to a book, or do you just move on?
Well, there was actually an offer for a book, but the Leroes decided they wanted to do theirs on their own. They didn't want to partner with me to write a book. So apparently there's a proposal floating out there from them right now, but I'm not a part of that.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to hear that. But you do have the consolation prize, the Pulitzer.
Yeah, I think that's okay.
And I know you told me that you're going to Columbia University next week to pick that up, I guess.
Yep, we get to go to a luncheon in the library there at Columbia on Thursday. So I'll be there with Mike Wilson, my editor, and with Melissa Little, the photographer, and Neil Brown, our editor, and all the PolitiFact team, who also won a Pulitzer this year. So we're looking forward to that.
I was Yeah, I was going to say, of course, that you weren't the only Pulitzer winner this year. Bill Adair and the Washington bureau chief and editor for PolitiFact also won one. We had Bill on the show last spring, I think. Did you notice after the announcement your coworkers holding their heads a little higher after winning two Pulitzers in one?
You know what? It was. I mean, it was as sad and scary as the print journalism industry has been this year, it felt that much more, I think, exciting and elating. Is that a word? Elation? I feel like an elation to walk into the newsroom and, like, I mean, people I only have ever seen in the elevator, you know, people from the business department and the IT department and the advertising department, and they all were proud. And the whole, you know, back area by Neil's office was filled with champagne, and it couldn't have felt better. It really did feel like it helped give everybody kind of a boost that we needed to go, yeah, maybe we're still doing something right, you know. And I also think because it was two different ends of the spectrum, you know, to have something as traditional as my feature stories about as old shoe leather human interest reporting as you can get, juxtaposed with something as innovative and web-based and just sort of kitschy but smart in terms of the way that what newspapers are going to have to do is what Bill and those guys did with PolitiFact. And so I think that was really cool that we had, you know, both ends of that spectrum. And then I need to give a shout-out to John Barry, too, who sits right beside me. He was a finalist for feature writing for his Winter's Tale about the dolphin. And that was even, you know, that was maybe right in the middle, because that was a little tiny short serial. I think he did six parts on that, and it was real, real short each segment versus my huge, long one-day run. So I think we got recognized on a lot of different planes, which was really neat, too.
Yeah, that's great. I actually remember being at the Clearwater Bureau of the Times, it must be about 25, when Lucy Morgan and Jack Reed and, gosh, I know I'm forgetting the third person on that, won Pulitzer for their reporting on I think it was the Pasco Sheriff at the time.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
It just completely changed the vibe and the mood for months, maybe years to come. You know, being part of that. I mean, I had no particular part in the reporting, but you're around these people who won the award, and it kind of, you know, it lifts the whole boat.
And they still have the balloons up in the lobby. You know, it's been almost a month, and I walked in there today thinking, surely they've taken everything down, and it's still there. So you still walk in and go, wow, it really did happen, you know.
I was going to ask you, I mean, does it make you face the kind of the uncertain future of the newspaper industry with a little more confidence about your own path and your newspapers?
That's a good question. When I called Karen Baird to tell her, you know, that it had won, she goes, "Hey, Lane, thanks. You just bought us each another year in our jobs." And that's kind of the feeling. Like, I've had so many people go, "Well, what do you want to do, you know, now that you've won the Pulitzer?" Well, I want to keep doing just what I'm doing at the St. Pete Times. I just hope, you know, I'm able to stay there another 20 years and that people are still, whether it's on the internet or on your driveway, I hope they're still wanting to read stories about people in their community and about everyday people.
That's fine. Listen, folks, you can read Lane DeGregory's remarkable three-part series, The Girl in the Window. It's online. At www, write this down, or back up the tape if you need to, www.tampabay.com/specials/2008/reports/Danielle, D-A-N-I-E-L-L-E, or goodbay.com, use the search engine, put in Girl in the Window. I'm sure it'll come up that way, too. We'll also have the link on MrMedia.com. And you can also see photos and hear more of Lane's interviews with the police and Danielle's past and current family members there. Lane, I know everybody's very proud of you, and it was nice to get to talk to you in some detail about this. And congratulations, and good luck picking up the award next week. I know that'll be another highlight.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with America's top journalists, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. For example, you can listen to my earlier conversation with Lane Gregory's fellow 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner and St. Pete Times Washington Bureau Chief Bill Adair, who is the editor of PolitiFact.com, and many more journalist interviews at the site. Please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media. He is one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, Pointer Online, MySpace, Facebook, NetVibes, Multiply, Zanga, DigitalJournal.com, Friendster, Orkut, Bebo, Tagged, iGoogle, Yahoo, Podcast Pickle, Vox, Folio, MediaFly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, or Odeo. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. And subscribe to Mr. Media in iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just media interviews within the podcast section of iTunes and click the free subscribe. It's that easy. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a little piece of your day to spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.